How do you like your coffee? Freshly roasted? You can just smell it, can't you? Well, how would you like it brought to you? If you're passionate about your coffee, then a Passion for the Bean is for you. At a Passion for the Bean, they custom roast coffee beans from around the world when you place your order, so your coffee is guaranteed to be fresh, rich, full-bodied, and full of flavor. That's not the taste that you get from coffee beans that have been sitting on a supermarket or coffeehouse shelf for weeks. Now, to have the ultimate coffee experience delivered to your home or office, call a Passion for the Bean at 480-703-2326. That's 480-703-BEAN. A Passion for the Bean has joined forces with the American Stroke Association in the fight to end stroke. Now, you can help by purchasing an ASA signature blend, and 30% of the proceeds will go directly to the ASA. Help us put an end to stroke. The life you save may be your own. And call a Passion for the Bean today, 480-703-2326.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
A car is a big investment, so get to AutoZone for everything you need to protect your car and make it look great. AutoZone has the brands you want at great prices, like Black Magic Tire Wet for a long-lasting extreme shine with no wiping, and Black Magic Pro Shine Protectant, now with Fade Block UV Blocker. Your choice, only $4.99. Give your car the protection it deserves. Get to AutoZone today.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
Hi, I'm Derek Cope, race car driver and TV analyst. You've probably heard me talk about Avacor, the revolutionary hair regrowth system that has been successful for most everyone who's used it. Now, listen to what Avacor users have to say about this remarkable treatment.
I am 39 years old. I've been slowly balding over the last 10 years. Thanks to Avacor, my hair is coming back and I couldn't be more excited.
The best product that I've tried.
Nothing has worked like this product to restore the hair that I had when I was in my 20s. Avacor is the product of the 21st century.
Avacor is safe and effective. It's worked for tens of thousands of satisfied users, including me. Let Avacor work to regrow your hair naturally.
Join the tens of thousands of satisfied Avacor users who have reversed their hair loss. Call toll-free 1-866-761-0954. Use Avacor risk-free for one full year. Call today 1-866-761-0954. That's 1-866-761-0954.
From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where every week we deal with mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance in our lives, body, mind, spirit, because without that balance, life's just too chaotic. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? So I want to start, actually, by welcoming all of you to listening here today and to let you know that if you call into the show tonight, and I'll tell you what the topic is, it's about money, and all of us have something to say about money. If you call into the show tonight, we're giving away two pairs of tickets to Mitch Albom's Tuesdays with Maury being produced at the Mesa Arts Center from June 2nd to June 11th, and the tickets will be free. It's the Arizona Theater Company, so the first two callers will each get a pair of tickets, and the number to call in is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. Now, I actually have a couple of guests this week, but I want to preface before I introduce my guests, because they're both people that are personally close to me. Today we're talking about money. Now, as the song goes, money makes the world go round, but can also make our heads spin and our guts explode and fear and terror instill in all of us. It could bring us a sense of playfulness and joy. It all depends on what our attitude is, and what we believe about money. So today we're going to take a look at how our beliefs and behavioral patterns around money can actually impact our emotional, psychological, and spiritual lives, as well as our relationships. So basically, today's show is about relationships. All of us have a relationship with money. Some of it, it's a very intimate relationship, and some of it, we just feel abandoned by that relationship, and we just never seem to have the connection that we really want. My belief and the way I work with things is the fact that our relationship with money is very often very similar to our relationships with people in our lives. Money is energy. So think for a minute how stuck you are energetically in your life, and whether that also reflects itself in how stuck you are in terms of income or money, or how you just can't seem to hold on to it. So today we're going to be talking about relationship then. And where does our sense of money come from usually? Well, you know, not to blame mom and dad, but usually our first teachers around money are mom and dad. You know, we may get an allowance, or we may have to work for our money. They talk to us about saving, or we see them constantly using credit cards and going into debt, or whatever it is. All of us have had some kind of mentoring when it comes to money, whether it's been direct, son, daughter, let's sit down, let's talk to you about money and how to handle it responsibly, or whether it's just been through observations. So that's what we're going to be talking about right now. And I guarantee that most of you listening to the show, whether you're driving your car, whether you're listening at home or in an office somewhere, are already thinking about your experiences with your mom and dad, what money was like in your home growing up, and how you handle it today. And that's really what we're going to be talking about today. So without further ado, I want to introduce two guests. I want to start with a friend of mine named Chris Lapp, who also happens to be my own mortgage broker and angel, since I've been going through some really rough stuff around some cash flow issues lately myself, and Chris has worked miracles for me. He's the founder and owner of Mortgage Discount Services in Los Angeles, and he's an incredible human being. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Great. And I also want to introduce someone else named David Altshuler. And if the name sounds familiar, yes, he is my younger brother. And he has his own company, Altshuler & Company, and he is a certified financial planner and investment advisor, as well as a whole list of other credentials. And David, I'm really glad that you're joining me on my show tonight. Welcome.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun, so let's get started.
Well, that's the intention, you
okay.
know. And money isn't always a fun thing for most people to deal with. So, Chris, let's start with you for a minute. I know that I remember my brother David saying years ago that he and I are in very similar occupations, because he, in a sense, does a lot of emotional and psychological counseling with his clients because of such attachments people have with money when he's suggesting certain investments or, you know, certain other financial planning issues. There is a lot of struggle that people go through. Now, I know, Chris, you saw it with me as we were refinancing my house about a month ago. How often do you find yourself dealing with people's emotional issues as you're helping them with their mortgages, and what do you see most commonly with people that you're working with?
Most of the people that call me are obviously looking for some kind of financial advice or guidance in terms of what they're trying to do with their lives, especially if it's involved in, you know, buying or refinancing a home, their biggest investment, which I think, you know, is also, you know, a psychological mainstay of where you live and how you live. Most people, however, having said that, don't know what they're trying to do. So, you know, I see myself almost in your position and David's position is trying to gap from the emotional side of it to the black and white common sense side of how do we get from point A to point B, and what are the long and short-term goals of that.
And when you're doing that, it's about goal setting. What seems to be some of the most common goals that you're working towards with people?
The funniest thing is everyone always asks me, the first question that comes out of their mouth is, you know, what is the interest rate? I hear that over and over and over again at the beginning of the transaction because we're all concerned and we all want to save money. Towards the end of the transaction, it's like, how long are we planning on staying in the house? What is our goal with the property? You know, does your wife or your partner or your husband, you know, are they going to be having to take on a second job to afford the payment? So I see a lot of that. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's the, especially if there is a partnership going on, you know, with a couple, everyone has to sit down and agree on the same goal. And I think that's probably the biggest challenge I see with most of my clients.
Mm-hmm. David, Chris is just saying is usually wrapped around the mortgage issue and home purchasing or refinancing.
Yeah.
You go to a wider expanse in terms of financial planning,
sure,
and investment counseling and things like that. What do you find in terms of the dynamics commonly that you need to help people with?
What Chris was just relating to is the idea of a specific goal for a specific transaction. What I do is much broader than that, and that my first question to my clients is, why are you here? What is it you need to see me about? What are you most concerned about your financial affairs? And once people start talking about that, then we try to get more specific. And in getting specific, I mean really specific. When I used to be a professor at CW Post, I used to ask my students that because we don't have the textbooks on the first night of class doesn't mean you don't have homework. It means you go home tonight and your homework is to write up a list of your goals. I want to know everything you want to do, be, or have for the rest of your life. If you tell me you want to be a chicken farmer, I want to know how many acres, how many chickens, how many chicken coops, how many pickup trucks. I want you to define your goals as completely as possible. And then I ask them, now that you've got the list, I want you to put time frames on those goals. What do you want to do 10 years from now, 50 years from now? What do you want to do 5 years from now? How about in the next 6 months? So in essence, I'm asking people to prioritize those goals. And once I understand what their goals are, now I know what motivates them. Now I can then talk to them about, how do you feel about the way your financial situation looks right now? How do you think you're going to feel 5 years from now if it doesn't change? 10 years from now? Where do you want to be in the future? And psychologically, that's a tricky question because a lot of people don't really have an answer to that. They'll all give you the status answer of, well, I want to retire, I got to put my kids through college, I want to buy a house, you know, the typical answers like that. But when you ask them to put time frames on it, prioritize it, and how do they feel about those things, then you start digging into stuff that's really kind of exciting. Because, face it, when I do a fact-finding for somebody and I get a list of their assets and a list of their insurances and their retirement accounts and everything else they have, my proposal to them is that, what is this all about? Right? These are just numbers on a piece of paper. But unless you could find a way to translate these numbers into taking action in your life to enhance your life and make it more enjoyable, then it's just numbers on a piece of paper. It doesn't mean anything. Let's convert these numbers into action. And people get excited when you start talking like that. Sometimes people freeze up. And they can't think about, well, I don't know really what I want to do. So I hand them a magic wand. I give them my pen. And I tell them to wave it up and down 3 times. Say the magic words, abracadabra. I say, now you have 3 wishes. Anything you could do, be, or have for the rest of your life, what would you want? And I get them to fantasize. And this is where the ability to be a counselor as well as a financial advisor comes into play. Because once I get them to really open up and understand what they really want to achieve in life, then just reallocating the assets is a pretty simple procedure.
Well, what you're talking about is a common tool. Like I said earlier, you and I, you acknowledge how you and I do very similar work in terms of our occupations. Basically, what you're talking about is helping people vision.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I know in my own life how uneducated I've been. I'm very good at certain things, but money has never really been an expertise of my own, although I've learned a lot and often learned the hard way. So, Chris, when people come to you for mortgage, how many of them do you find really don't know much about the procedure of applying for money and what the black and white, as you said, really entails around this? I mean, how much of what you do is really educational?
99%. I'm serious. The question that popped into my head, because since you came from the same family and what you said in the introduction about how we learn from our parents, I'm going to ask the host the question.
That's okay.
How did David, you know, land in the money business?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a real simple answer to that. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, a friend of mine said, "I'm going to the candy store. Do you want to come?" So I went upstairs and I got my savings, which was all of about $3, and I went with him to the candy store on 80th Avenue in Floral Park, New York, and I spent my entire $3 on comic books, which were about 10 cents a piece at that time. And I came home with a stack of comic books, and my father said to me, "Where'd you get those?" And I told him I went to the candy store with my friend and I spent my $3. And he immediately spanked me, and then he took me back to the candy store with all the comic books and returned them, and the man gave me back the money, basically. And I think that was my first lesson in economics.
Don't spend your money unwisely.
That's right. I mean, you know, the fact that I still remember it to this day, you know, that one event may have, been the provocation for me to study finance a little bit more was kind of interesting, because apparently it had a significant impact on my father. Now, my father was a child of the Depression, basically. And so, you know, when you're a little kid, you don't go blowing all your money on one thing. And that was a very important lesson for me to learn at that time.
And I learned something different in the process. I'm really glad you asked this, Chris, because, you know, sometimes even siblings grow up in the same house and never have discussions like this. Although David and our brother Mark and I, it's not unusual for us to talk on this level. But the thing that I remember most about how my parents taught me about money is I always remember once a month, I think, or twice a month, my mom and dad sitting down in the dining room and with the stack of bills and the checkbook, and I remember them always. One of them, one of them always wrote the check, the other one always opened the envelope. So both of them knew what was going on that level with the finances. And it's interesting because to this day, I hate paying bills online. There's still something so organic to me about sitting down with the stack of bills and the checkbook and writing them out and stuffing the envelopes and mailing them out.
Yeah, but the real problem was that mommy's attitude was, "What do you mean there's no money left in the account? I still have checks left in the book."
Right. Chris, what'd you say?
Oh, I was just thinking that it seems to me that in all the thousands of clients I've had, that the ones who are more involved in the check writing process are more in control of their finances versus the ones that use auto pay, click this, click that.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it does make it more real. Like I said, it's more organic. And to me, like I said in my opening, relationships are about our connection to a lot of different things, and we all have a relationship with money. And when it becomes a more organic one, I may not always have great cash flow in terms of what's coming in, and I do admit that, as both of you know, I can often have more going out than I have coming in, as a lot of Americans do, but there is a relationship there.
Well, I think,
and a relationship is meant to grow and heal things and to make changes along the way.
Well, the statistics say that 4 out of 5 relationships break up over money.
That's true.
Which is so powerful. And I think that, you know, here in the United States, we're so in tune with, you know, spending, shopping, and buying, that if we're not both on the same page, then we do get ourselves into massive amounts of debt very quickly, and it's very difficult to get out.
And it also is about communication, because with most couples, if you think about it, one doesn't tell the other. There's always financial secrets going on. Not always, but often there are financial secrets going on, and shame and guilt attached to certain things they've done or not done with the money. So there are secrets around money, just like there are secrets around other behaviors that occur in a lot of relationships.
Part of the issue is that individuals don't take responsibility for their own actions when it comes to money.
I think that's true when it comes to a lot of things. I mean, that's a real foundation of a lot of the work I do with most of my clients in terms of taking personal responsibility and also learning how to take credit personally and not minimize their achievements. So I do think that it's, like I said, the relationship with money is very similar to our relationships with so many other things. And if you're not willing to take personal responsibility to things around money, you probably don't take it around other things in your life. So, with the situation with finances, and I'm trying to go back and forth to both of you, because I invited you both here because you're two people I really tremendously respect and appreciate when it comes to money. And both of you have, in a sense, been a mentor to me, especially in recent years. So what seems to be the biggest mistakes you see people making around money?
Well,
David, why don't you start?
Biggest mistake is not planning. Biggest mistake is just thinking that everything's going to take care of itself, that at some point they'll either inherit some money or they'll accumulate money in a retirement account. And as people,
or they'll win the lottery.
Yeah, well, you know, they're just wishing and hoping, but they're not taking action. And that's a sad situation, because with some very basic financial education, you can learn the rudiments of what you need to do in order to accumulate enough to achieve your goals. And for most people who have a standard of living that allows them to save, it's really not difficult. I have to get a certain habit going called pay yourself first, which means putting something away from every source of income every time you get some small percentage or a fixed dollar amount, so that as time goes by and that money is properly invested, you'll start to see some accumulation of it, and you'll start to feel as though it's a self-rewarding process, where when you start to feel the sense of achievement from it, You'll get it, basically. You'll know that you've done the right thing and that you'll be fixed now in this habit, because you'll see the benefits of it. But it's getting started, particularly for young people, in that process and knowing how to allocate their resources among all their different needs, knowing what's really important to them. Is it more important for immediate gratification, or is it more important for them to have a future? And generally, younger people are more interested in immediate gratification. As they mature, they start to realize that if they go on that path continuously, they're not going to have anything for the future, and their habits are going to get better of them. So it's a maturity process, I think, that really makes a big difference. And it's being around other successful people that really makes a big difference. I think, you know, all of us, no matter what profession we have or what role we play in life, should try to surround ourselves with the smartest people we could find, so that we don't have to learn everything the hard way, you know, from scratch. We could benefit from their experience. So you just mentioned before about us being mentors for you, and I encourage all of my clients to use me as a sounding board to get an education and to come back to me with questions, because if there's something they don't understand, that's my job, is to educate them. And the more I educate them, the better decisions they're going to make. And that's what it comes down to, is making good decisions and having people around you whose advice you can trust. And unfortunately, in the field of finance these days, most of the people in the field have to sell you something to make a living, you know. So there's an inherent conflict of interest. Who are they looking out for? Are they looking out for you to help you make a good decision? Or are they looking out for themselves because they have to pay their bills too? So that creates a whole nother topic of trust in the area of making financial decisions, and that's something that people unfortunately learn about from bad experiences rather than getting an education up front. Mm.
Chris, how about you? What are the biggest mistakes you see coming in?
Debt. Debt will
will pull someone down faster than they could even realize, because if you're outspending what you're bringing in, there's no way to reverse that trend. I mean, you only have 24 hours in a day to work. So basically what I try to give my clients as a standard, live beneath your means. Don't have to drive the fanciest car. Go to the budget stores and buy your clothes. You don't have to be wearing name brands. Make sure that you have a free checking account. These $8 and $10 monthly service charges and here and there, and they will pull you down fast. Make sure that, if you're not watching TV every night, $100 a month cable bill will chew up your budget fast. And like what David was saying, it's very smart. Pay yourself 5% at minimum, out of every paycheck that you get. That's a start. Sock that money away, hide it away. I mean, I even have a banking account in San Diego just to put the money away, so it's very difficult for me to get to.
Huh.
Little things like that turn into good habits over the long run. The most successful clients I have aren't the ones that make the most money, but are the ones that save the most.
Hmm.
Yeah, Stu, about,
go ahead, Dave.
I think in 1980 I wrote an article that was published in a couple of magazines, and it was called The Economics of Smoking. And first I did an analysis of the profits that the tobacco companies made, and then I did an analysis of what it really cost you. And at the point in time when I did that, I think we were talking about 75 cents a pack or something like that. And that if you stop smoking and put away that 75 cents a day from not smoking anymore and compound it at 5% for 30 years, you'd have something like $208,000. I mean, it was absurd how simple it was. And all you had to do is do something that would save your life and help you live longer. So it's little things.
So
like
you could
that.
Enjoy the money, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you're alive long enough to enjoy it, So mm-hmm. it's little things like that, trading a bad habit for a good habit, which, mm-hmm. It's a double benefit, basically.
It's a great idea. I'm going to remind my listeners, again, if you have some questions for Chris Lapp, David Altshuler, or myself, Stuart Altshuler, the number is 480-949-1310. And if you're interested in a pair of tickets to Tuesdays with Maury at the Mesa Arts Center from June 2nd to 11, the first two callers will get a free pair of tickets. Chris, you brought up something that you both know I know well enough, and that's about debt. Let's talk about debt a little bit more. I've recently, been able to pay off all my credit cards, and I can't tell you the sense of freedom that comes with it. And at the same time, and I think this is healthy for me because I've never been in this position before, I'm actually nervous about spending the money that I got out of my refi and the sale of that house. I'm actually nervous about seeing myself go through it. And
excellent.
I think the stress and the insanity that I was living in, that both of you are aware of during those months, was a hard lesson, a hard way to learn the lesson. And David, you said something that I talk about all the time. We can choose to learn something through sweat and tears and suffering, or we can choose to learn something more gentler. So this attitude is, I now actually am in a better financial situation than I've ever been in my life, and there's still that thought, there's still not enough. And I think that belief system that it's never enough, we don't have enough, also is usually something that comes down from our family patterns and things like that. But my guess is both of you have experienced people who had tremendous amounts of money and still had that poverty or that that never enough type of attitude.
Well,
what do you do with
that? Let me comment
on
that. I deal with this all the time, because in setting people's goals, once they reach a particular level financially, a level of assets, maybe $500,000, million, $2 million, $3 million, whatever it is, that word enough is actually a moving target, meaning that if you ask somebody who has almost no money, how much, would you consider rich? they might say $500,000 or $1 million. All right? You ask somebody who has $1 million how much would be rich, they'll say $2 to $3 million. If you ask somebody who has $2 to $3 million, they'll say $5 million. If you have somebody who has $5 million, they'll say $10 million. If you have somebody who says $10 million, they'll say $20 million. It's a moving target because once you achieve a certain level of affluence, you don't consider yourself that affluent anymore because you see it's just a number on a piece of paper. It doesn't really change the way you feel about yourself internally until you really reach a level where, based on your history and the comparison to your peers, you start to outshine them and you start to feel somewhat really secure in your position in relation to them. That doesn't necessarily mean you're rich. It may mean you're just hanging out with the wrong crowd or something, or not with very wealthy people or something. But in your eyes at that moment, you feel content in your position in reference to other people. And that is a better definition of rich than just putting a number on it.
Mm-hmm. I actually had that experience with a client a number of years ago who, to anybody's eyes, you know, he had millions of dollars and was very comfortable and yet, like you're saying, most of his friends were, you know, may have had hundreds of millions, so he always felt like the poor one in the group. And it really affected him self-esteem-wise and confidence-wise. And at the same time, he was an incredibly successful human being and obviously earned all the wealth and comfort that he had earned. But it's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's almost as though, it's kind of the golden mean. In that when you have an idea of something and you spend so many years trying to accomplish that and you get close to that goal, you suddenly realize that what you thought it was going to be like is nothing like what it is, and now your perception of what you're trying to achieve changes dramatically. And this is the whole process we all go through in life, is that we never really become self-actualized, I guess it means. You know, we're always striving for something else because we got close to what we thought it was and it's not really what we were looking for. And unfortunately, how much money we make or how much money we have kind of defines us, you know. And I think people have to get away from that. I think, you know, people suffer with this definition of who they are based on what's in their checkbook. And that's really kind of silly when it comes right down to it, because we are so much more than that, you know.
And yeah,
Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, let's add to that. That's exactly right. And I would think that, you know, if we need to put blinders on when it comes to our personal finances and do what works for us as individuals. Things do not bring happiness, as we know. Do not lie up your wealth upon the earth. Kind of those old philosophies, I think, are very important. Do what works for you. Like I said earlier, you know, don't try to outspend the Joneses because you'll never be able to keep up with them. Do what works for you. Know your own personal goals. Know where you're going to be happy. Happiness doesn't lie in things. In fact, I think that the less you have, the happier my clients seem to be, which is kind of the opposite of what the media and everything is telling us. They're saying buy this, buy that, buy this, buy this, and we'll be happy. But in fact, the less we have, the more freedom we have.
Well, they've learned how to simplify.
Yeah,
definitely.
Well, Jimmy Carter had a way of doing that. Jimmy Carter, I kind of admire sometimes because he had a lot of good sayings. One of them was, show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser. But one of the things he brought to Washington was something called zero-based budgeting. And zero-based budgeting was kind of a new concept at the time, because prior to that, what they would do is they'd take the federal budget and they would just pick an inflation number and they would just increase the budget by that percentage for all the different departments. But Jimmy said, let's not do it that way. Let's take another stance. Let's do what we call zero-based budgeting, meaning that instead of just increasing the amount we're spending for each thing, let's take a look at each thing and decide whether we need it at all to begin with. And by doing that, he was able to cut a lot of fat out of the federal government. And since then, a lot of corporations have adopted that theory as well. And individuals seem to be doing it as well, and it seems to work a lot for a lot of people.
You know, sometimes less is more.
Yeah, there's a limit to it, but you find you can free yourself, you know, emotionally as well as financially.
Definitely.
By shedding some of the things that you think you need. I mean, I'm a perfect example. I joined a health club. It was like $1,400 for the year. In the first month, I went about 12 times. In the second month, I went 6 times. In the third month, I went 2 or 3 times. I haven't seen it in 6 months, you know? So do I really need to spend money on a health club? Not unless I'm really going to use it, and obviously, who am I kidding, you know? So it's not,
you know, or the health club that the gym I belong to is $159 a year.
Well, exactly. That's a bargain for that, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you don't use it, it's still a waste of money.
Exactly.
You know?
So now, there's a little book that I actually found on my shelf by a guy named Gerald Mundus, and it's literally a little book. It's about 3 inches by 2 inches, one of those very simplified how-tos and higher consciousness about money. And this one's called How to Free Yourself from Debt. And in there, speaking of debt, he says, debt is a form of poverty. It makes you think you have more money than you do. And to me, when I read that, it just resonated and rang so true, because a lot of people walk around with those credit cards and, I'll be able to pay it off in a month or two. I'll buy that pair of shoes, or I can pay it off in a few months. I'm going to splurge and treat myself. And that's how we usually end up, you know, maxing out one credit card and starting another one. So what do you... In terms of debt and in terms of people's attitude about what that credit card means as they're walking around in their pocket with it, what do you say to them? What advice do you have?
Well, it's again, a behavior pattern, and it's one that has to be broken. And sometimes I'll tell people, just leave your credit cards home for a month, and then you won't really need them anymore. You know,
mm-hmm.
Just get used to not having them, and you'll get used to not being able to use them, and you'll see it does change things.
Very good. When we're talking,
throw something in there too.
Go ahead, Chris. Yes, please.
Yeah, I think that those credit cards that we have in all of our wallets or purses, you know, equal power. And once again, we were talking about what we could buy with. We could ultimately buy. I think my credit card has a $50,000 limit on it. I mean, $50,000. I think if you paid the minimum payment, it'd be like 300 years to pay it off.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling my clients, one credit card. If you have rent or a mortgage payment, that's it. That's all you need to have. It's all you need to carry around and pay that thing off every month religiously, even if it kills you. Even if you're eating top ramen, don't let the balance roll over, because we know the minute the balance rolls over, they charge you interest on the entire amount, just not on the part that you didn't pay. That. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
So that will be, I'm adamant about that. You go ahead and use that credit card. Watch what you're spending, because it's easy to buy dinner, buy this. You know, you're around town buying gas these days. When that bill comes, open it up, pay it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Just get rid of the money, pay that thing off. After 6 months of doing that, you'll stop spending as fast as you were before.
Well, one of the things I found since you guys help guide me through getting out of all my debt, is I use my debit card more, and if I have to use a credit card, I'll use my American Express, because that has to be paid off each month.
Excellent. Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm also carrying more cash around and paying for a dinner with cash and doing other things, and it feels real good to know that I get my credit card statements now, you know, this month, and they all have zero balances.
Yeah,
that's an amazing thing to look at.
And that's,
Stu,
that's
the other thing you need to keep in mind is that in order to control the spending in the future, you need to plan your purchases. You
mm-hmm.
know, make up a list of the things you need and make a shopping trip just to get those specific things, and that way you mm-hmm. start to kill some of the impulsive spending, you know?
Right. Chris, what were you going to say?
Well, that's the reward. I mean, that's the ultimate reward, that you're in control of your finances. And then you can be sending, you know, a couple, maybe people don't even realize starting with $25 a month, start saving it like David was saying, that over time could add up to be a tremendous amount of money. And you could see, instead of spending the money, as you're saving it, you have a lot more confidence, control. And that will actually snowball into becoming rich,
mm-hmm.
even that small amount.
Let's talk about that in terms of, because there are a lot of people out there who You know, I'm 56 years old and baby boom generation, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of us have gone through the credit card and the, you know, living high type of thing. What do you say to people who are in their 40s and 50s and all of a sudden wake up and realize they haven't set up a retirement fund? They have nothing in savings. And what do you say to them when they're thinking, well, it's too late now. I'm going to be living on Social Security when I retire.
Well, it's never too late to start. You have to start immediately once you realize you have the problem. And you have to double up on it. You really have to set your priorities on what's important. I mean, people are living longer today than ever before, sometimes even longer than Mother Nature intended. And that's going to be a tremendous burden on everybody financially. But you got to look at the other side of it, too, is that the average retirement age in the U.S. is around 62. And even though people aren't totally withdrawing from the workforce, they might work part-time or be consultants or something like that. When you look at Europe, the average retirement age there is around 58, 59. How can people afford to retire so young? Because they have better pension systems over in Europe than we have here. Or people who are conscientious about putting money in their 401ks, and if they're not doing it now, they definitely should be doing it, because you know nobody's going to do it for you. You know, you're responsible for your own future, basically. So the sooner you start to realize that and take control of it, the better you're going to feel. And it's not that difficult. If you look at the banks, sometimes when they advertise for IRAs and they say if you put away $4,000 a year, compounding the X percent, you know it'll grow to a tremendous amount. The key to that is starting as early as possible, because you're not losing the first year of compounding. You're losing year 15 or 20 or 25 of compounding, where the money increases in value sometimes three or four to fold in 1 year. So the key is time plus money plus investing equals financial independence. And
say that again.
Time plus money plus investing equals financial independence.
Okay. Everybody hear that. Time plus money, plus investing. Just having the money sitting around is not going to help it build.
No.
And if you don't know the beginning or the, I mean, if you have no idea really what to do about investing, it's just like finding a good therapist, and I say this to people all the time. If you're looking for a good therapist, take a look at the people you know that may be in therapy that you really respect and have been seeing growth happening. Find out who they're seeing, because it's usually the best way of doing it. And I think both of you alluded earlier to, if you're looking for a good financial planner or a mortgage broker and stuff, talk to the people around you that have been having good fortune with the people that they're working with. You don't have to look in the yellow pages and do this cold.
Yeah, it's more than that, though, because you have to set certain criteria. It's not just a referral, because the person may have just had a good couple of years with somebody. You know, the criteria I would use in looking for somebody to guide you in this is somebody who's doing this 20 years or more. I mean, that's the type of experience that shows you they've been doing it through good and bad times and been able to succeed through that. And there's tons of people who have had that kind of experience. So I don't want to walk into a bank and just sit down with somebody who got their securities license 2 months ago and he's going to tell me how to plan my future. There's too much of that going on, and those where the mistakes are being made. You need somebody with a long history of experience. And not only that, don't be afraid to ask them, what do you do with your money? You know, what makes you so successful?
Absolutely.
You know, am I getting my advice from somebody who has no money, or am I getting my advice from somebody who is so successful by taking his own advice that he doesn't need to be working anymore? Who would you rather deal with, basically? And it's not a bad idea to ask them, what's the best investment you ever made? What's the worst investment you ever made? And check their credentials. Is anybody that has a securities license, you could find out from the National Association of Securities Dealers if they have any complaints or violations on their records from dealing dishonorably with people. And you'd be amazed how many people have those kind of records that are still allowed to practice. So check the people out. Make sure they have a very strong history of being successful in the business, and that they have their own resources that you can verify in some way that shows you that they've taken their own advice and succeeded with it. But to go into, you know, a person, a friend, you know, I get this all the time, oh, my nephew just got his securities license, I'm going to move my account to him. I'm like, well, don't be afraid to call me when you want to come back. I mean, you know? So that's what you're looking for, is the experience. because there are so many variables in what we do, and the only way you learn how to understand those variables is experience. I mean, I know people that have tons of credentials, just like myself, but every day we're still learning. And if you get somebody who's not learning, they're dead to you. Doesn't help you at all.
And that again is that overlap of being a therapist, because it's the same thing. If the therapist that you're seeing or you're looking for is not also committed to their own personal growth and development, then something's going to be off there also. So, Chris, I want to ask you also, I mean, David was talking about, you know, how to find the right financial planner, but there are so many people out there who deal with mortgages. You got banks to go to, you got companies like yours, you know, in terms of mortgage brokers, and then you also have all of these online, you know, mortgage companies that you hear advertising constantly and see on billboards constantly, advertising like so much less in terms of interest rate than I think most banks would even give or a mortgage broker can find. What's the difference? Why would somebody go to someone like you, although I could answer that myself, why would someone go to someone like you as opposed to walking into their bank or going to one of these online mortgage companies?
Oh, I've heard this question a lot, and it's one of my actually favorite questions. It's exactly what Dave had to say. There are so many, excuse the expression, but yahoos out there who just jumped into the business to make a quick dime, who don't have any experience how to give financial advice or what direction someone should take in terms of the overall picture like we discussed earlier and the specific picture for each individual, what their target is. When it comes to rates, you know, if it's too good to be true, it's not good. It's just not. It isn't possible. The, you know, it's a very competitive market. Everyone is basically lending out money. You know, the government sets what the rates are going to basically be, and no one's going to be better or worse than anybody else once you get to a certain level. So, you're going to be looking for long-term experience, good referral. Make sure that you do ask for the resume. You know, I've been doing this for years. Not one person has ever asked me for my resume, any credentials. It always surprises me. I offer that up. That's the bottom line, is basically to look around and make sure that you do ask your friends, well, was this a good experience or a bad experience? What would you do? How would you do differently? And I often hear, oh, well, my cousin got 3%. And I'm like, well, what was the specifics about the deal? Were they going to be in there for a year? Or are they going to stay in there for 30 years? You know, is it a negative amortization? You know, I could go through the whole list of all everything that's important. But once again, people don't always talk about what the details are. They're just trying to outdo each other. Always go off a good referral.
Great. Now, I want to respond to something that, David, you said about, you know, maybe that client has a nephew that just, you know, got his or her certification to do this and they want to. To me, I think it would be great for that relative to want to support the journey that their niece or nephew is starting and maybe to take a small amount and transfer it over as a way of showing, you know, some love and good faith while still maintaining the bulk of what they're investing with that person that has already proven themselves to be really effective and given them some security.
Well, I'll give you the answer to that. That's a simple one. How much is that relationship worth? Because it's about to cost you tens of thousands of dollars.
Well, maybe, maybe not. But the question is, are you willing to risk some of it because the relationship is worth something?
Never.
You know what? most new agents or representatives or whatever are going to understand that their established relationships that the relative has with their existing professionals, if it's a satisfactory relationship, there'd be no reason to change it. All right. If the guy's not doing his job, maybe then you might want to experiment somewhere else. But if it ain't broke, don't fix it, because this a decision about what to do in the hands of an inexperienced person can cost literally tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, even in experienced people. Because I had a situation about 2 years ago where a woman was at a major brokerage house, and they just had a certain philosophy that no more than a certain amount of somebody's assets should be in one thing. And, of course, diversification is a very major role in everybody's investment portfolio. But in this case, they unnecessarily and overdid it, and the position that they changed for this client doubled in the next year. And had they left it alone, she would have made $200,000 more. I mean, so, you know, even the experts aren't always right. But to put it in the hands of somebody brand new in the industry, you know, what are the odds that they're going to be right? You know, that's what I'm saying, is that you got to work the probabilities. And the probability is somebody with 20 or 30 years' experience is more likely to do the job. And if you're investing tens of thousands of dollars, and how hard do you have to work to make that? Just because, you know, you want to try to please a relative, when that relative is already happy with your relationship to begin with, you're not obligated, you know? There's no motivation there. You know, you have to put aside the emotional for a second and separate it from the financial, because emotionally you'd like to help them. You can tell them so, and you can tell them how proud you are of them and stuff like that. But in a couple of years, maybe I'll transfer some of my money to you. You don't have to do it right out of the gate. If they're still in the business in a couple of years, at least they have a chance to prove themselves and show that they know what they're doing. But to do it right off the bat, you're making an emotional decision, not a financial decision. And that's the problem. You've got to be able to separate those.
Good point. Let's talk about that. We have maybe about 6 minutes left. Let's talk about the emotionality that's involved with money and decision-making. You know, Chris, during the last 6 months, has been a therapist to me. I was on the phone almost every day with him, and when I didn't call him, he or his assistant were calling me. I mean, there was a real sense of awareness and caring about what I needed and was going through, and that's, to me, quite an amazing thing that a professional personalizes that relationship so much. And I publicly thank you, Chris, for being
there. You're welcome.
But talk about the emotionality that's involved with decision-making around money.
I'll give you this on that. Usually when somebody comes into money for the first time or comes into a lot of money, even if they're fairly well off, I try to set them up in what's known as a no-decision zone. That means for the first 6 or 9 months after this happens, they don't make any major decisions about their money. Mm-hmm. Let it just sit. Let's get comfortable with the idea that we have this. Let's get an education. Let's ask a lot of questions. There's no great urgency. Nobody out there should convince you that you must act now, because it's more important to make a right decision than a quick decision. So I do that as, you know, sometimes people coming into money as a result of a traumatic event, the loss of a loved one or a lawsuit from damages or, you know, a car accident or something like that, those people are especially vulnerable. And we want to make sure that when they finally do make a decision, they're going to be totally comfortable and not regret it later on. And that requires an adjustment period. That requires some time so they get used to this whole new situation and they get an education about what are the good points, what are the bad points, what's going to actually help them achieve their financial goals in the long run. And so anybody who rushes you, who tries to convince you you got to do it today, don't do business with that person, because that's not in your best interest. Your best interest is somebody who can sit down and educate you first so you understand what you're doing. And we talked about taking responsibility, you know, for your own actions. That's the ultimate, you know, person who's going to be responsible, because you're going to either enjoy or suffer from the consequences of these decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't put that off on an inexperienced broker who tells you buy this and it goes down to zero or something because it was your own fault for using somebody inexperienced, you know. So keep that in mind.
Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
We have a little bit different take on it, because what he does is a little bit different from me, because I have to deal with the here and now. Somebody brings me a set of circumstances. You know, in a loan application, there's about 250 questions, and I have to make black and white decisions made based upon that information that was provided.
Well, you're in a different business. You're in a transaction-oriented business. You have, you know,
well, that's
what
he's saying, yeah.
Definitely.
So, yeah, I'm in the long term, like I guide people over 20 years sometimes, you know.
I like to think of myself as the buck stops here kind of a guy. And in if you don't mind me saying, in your particular situation, you know, we had to make specific decisions on that. Spending is not going to work. We need to do X, Y, and Z, black and white. And a lot of times people don't want to hear what I have to say, but they're relieved after they go through the process, and when they do listen to me, that they think, okay, that was the right decision. So when it comes to money, like you're saying, giving it to a niece or nephew, only go with a seasoned professional. Let them make the decisions for you. Take the emotion out of it. start saving, you know, a dollar a day, a couple dollars a day, and you'll be surprised how fast that grows, and you'll see yourself becoming more successful on an emotional level. But you have to take control of it and look at it from the black and white emotion. Mm-hmm. Emotion does not work.
Well, that is why I actually wanted to do this show, and we only have about a minute left. And if people who are listening got anything out of this, hopefully you're seeing how there is no separation between your relationship with money and the emotional, psychological, spiritual, and relationship issues that we have going on in our lives. It reflects one to the other. So I really want people to take to heart some of the things Chris and David and myself have been saying here. And if it's made you uncomfortable, then that's because you really needed to hear it and it's shaking some of your beliefs. So, Christopher Lapp, thank you so much for spending your Friday night with us.
Thank you, Stuart.
David Altshuler, I really appreciate you because it's 3 hours different for you, so it's almost 11 o'clock there for you. I really, I'm very grateful to both of you for all you've done for me, but also for being here tonight. So this is Stuart Altshuler on KXAM in Phoenix, 1310 AM. Tell the truth faster. I'll be back next Friday night, same time. And everybody have a great weekend and a safe one for Memorial Day.